The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey. Welcome back to Inside Medicine. I have a fantastic program planned, and we have an expert allergist, Dr. George Belenkoch, will be with us. George is the head of a three-man group and along 295 and has been in business a long time. And he's going to talk about a very, very nice intro. Quote, allergies, nothing to sneeze at. I am just going to give, before I introduce George, I'm just going to give a little update. In the paper today, specifically Barron's, there was a great article for people who are going to approach needing a Medicare insurance. So what insurance package are you going to participate in when it's time for your Medicare? Over 50% of Medicare recipients go to Medicare Medical Advantage plans. Would a Medicare Medigap plan be a better deal for you? Are hospital chains and medical providers dropping Advantage plans, citing low payments and administrative hassles? Are Medical Advantage sectors facing unprecedented increases in medical cost trends? Should a consumer seek help from a neutral third party versus pitchmen like Shatner and Namath when enrolling in a Medicare plan? Check out Barron's 325-2024, page 17, 18, and 19 with an excellent article. If Medicare plan is approaching you, you want to basically get some advice, make sure you pick out the right one. Remember, a decision today can mean the same deal for 30 years. Let me just introduce George. George is a fantastic allergist, heads a three-man group up in Burlington County. He's been in business a long time. High-quality player, great depth. George, welcome to the Inside Medicine.
Hi, Joe, and thank you for inviting me this morning to be part of your program.
Hey, it's my pleasure. So, George, you've set a goal here for me to make sure that the audience learns a lot. Can I just start off with something that's maybe the rain might help out right now, but what can we expect this spring for the pollen?
Yeah, the spring pollen season is actually off to an early start and a rather strong start. It's likely been bolstered by that heavy rain we've had leading into the spring season and, of course, the rain that we're seeing today. As a matter of fact, earlier this month, during a spring of kind of a string of warm days, my partner Don DeVoren, who is a certified pollen counter for the National Allergy Bureau, reported that tree pollen was already at very high levels. Certainly, those levels will be dampened today in the rain, though will rebound as soon as it dries out. Most recently, he's been seeing high levels of maple, cedar, and juniper tree pollen. And in our offices, we've had a number of patients that have come in this month, you know, already complaining of spring allergy symptoms. So we're only at the beginning. As a matter of fact, grass pollen is expected to arrive in either early or mid-April. And historically, both tree and grass pollen have peaked, you know, in the later part of April and into early May. But the seasons have been getting earlier and longer. And we expect the pollen levels to remain high right well into the month of June. So anybody who's interested in following those pollen levels can actually go to our website at yourallergydocs.com and they can receive updated pollen counts.
So George, just tell me, how come the rain will help decrease the pollen counts? Maybe a dumb question, but just curious.
No, well, pollen, definitely not a dumb question. Pollen is a wind-borne dispersion. So it requires dry and warm and windy conditions to best disperse and to involve a larger area. So when it rains, it dampens the pollen particles and they essentially fall to the ground and they're unable to be windborne in those conditions. So the pollen levels will drop on a rainy day, though as soon as things dry out, things typically rebound.
So what are the most common pollens in the air, especially during this aggressive spring pollen season?
Yeah, my partners and I published a paper in 2001 in the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. It actually defined the most common pollens observed in the Philadelphia metropolitan area. The pollen levels recorded again by Dr. DeVorin. He had stations both located in Philadelphia and Cherry Hill. And of course, the most common pollens overall are tree and grass pollens, but more specifically, because people are sometimes interested in specific tree pollens, during that study, we saw the highest levels for maple, oak, birch, pine, and cedar trees. And of course, prominent grass pollens are the northern grasses like Kentucky, orchard, rye, and timothy. And interestingly, pollen levels were noted in that study to be largely similar in the urban environment of Philadelphia and the suburban environment in Cherry Hill. You would think there'd be a whole lot more pollen in Cherry Hill, but because pollens are windborne, as we mentioned earlier, and capable of traveling for miles from their source, even people in Philadelphia feel the impact, you know, from their rural and suburban neighbors. So pollen levels are certainly at their highest on warm and windy days, and again, we said just a minute ago, lowest on rainy days.
So I'm glad it's a rainy day today, but it's bad for your business, I would assume, so, but you don't need any help. So let me ask you this. What are the typical symptoms that a patient would experience during spring pollen, which is now?
Yeah, right. Well, patients with spring pollen allergy typically experience eye and nasal symptoms. So they'll come in complaining of itchy eyes, watery eyes, itching of their ears, nose, and throat. They get nasal congestion, runny nose, and usually it's a clear nasal discharge because it's not an infection. And of course, they do a good amount of sneezing. And really, the key symptom that I look for, the symptom that separates allergic types of nasal problems from non-allergic problems, is itching, because that's really almost pathognomonic for an allergy patient. So that makes it pretty clear to me that that's the problem. But also patients with allergies commonly have asthma. And patients with asthma could come in complaining of chest tightness or shortness of breath or coughing or wheezing. So they're the majority of the typical symptoms.
So can you just explain that word, pathognomonic? Maybe I got that wrong, but what did that mean?
Oh, that is pretty much classic for an allergy person. So if I hear itching, I think allergy, as opposed to any other possibility like chronic sinus disease or non-allergic rhinitis or rhinitis that's triggered by just non-allergic exposures.
So, George, everything gets a little bit more complicated, as I can see. When someone comes to you, they're looking for help. I guess they got the sneezing and everything else. What can the allergy sufferers remedy to themselves with to try and avoid the hit of the spring pollen, which we're in now?
Yeah, during the spring pollen season, when possible, it's important to minimize exposure to the outdoor environment. Now, I know people want to be outdoors, and a lot of people like having their windows and doors, you know, open, or especially the windows during the spring season. But it would be advisable when they are indoors to keep their windows and doors closed and, you know, keep their air conditioning on. So because by opening those windows, they let in a large amount of pollen, which can aggravate their symptoms. Now, also, if they do go outside, which of course everybody wants to go outside in the spring, it would be important when they come indoors to shower and change their clothes, because the majority of pollen is not visible to the naked eye. And boy, hair and clothes could be a significant reservoir inside, to hold pollen that can continue to cause ongoing issues. So of course, people want to be outdoors, and that's kind of where allergists come in. We help them get outdoors by, you know, prescribing them the appropriate medications, and in some instances, allergy shots to help reduce those allergic symptoms and better tolerate being outdoors.
So when someone hits the pharmacy to try and get some over-the-counter help, is that usually effective? And what would be some of your recommendations if one of your patients is trying to hit the pharmacy to try and get some acute help real quick?
Yeah. Well, fortunately for allergy patients, over recent years, more and more allergy medications have become available over the counter, which are, you know, very effective in managing their symptoms. Now, the two major classes of medications, of course, are the oral antihistamines and either steroid or antihistamine nasal sprays. In regard to the oral antihistamines, we generally recommend that people look for the newer second-generation oral antihistamines like Allegra, Claritin, Zyrtec, and Zizol, because these medications, they only require once-a-day dosing. And more importantly, they're either non-sedating or only minimally sedating, and they're generally well-tolerated. A lot of people still rely on the older generation antihistamines, such as Benadryl. Well, Benadryl does work, but it's generally short-acting, so you have to take it multiple times each day. And it could also cause significant sedation and other side effects that really get in the way of using this medication. So people really should be careful if they take Benadryl because it can impair them. So that's why we really recommend those second-generation agents. And in terms of nasal sprays, there are some nasal sprays that are also available over-the-counter that are highly effective, like Flonase nasal spray and Nasacort nasal spray. And there's even a nasal antihistamine available now over the counter called Astepro nasal spray, which works very well in managing nasal allergy. Now, in terms of prescription sprays, there's actually two out there that actually combine both a nasal steroid and a nasal antihistamine, so they're more effective than either agent alone. And they're named Dymista nasal spray, which has been out for several years, and Ryaltris nasal spray, which is more recent, probably the past year or two. But they combine both the nasal steroid and the nasal antihistamine. I think the important thing to drive home about most of these medications, it is best to use them on a daily basis throughout the spring pollen season, because it's much easier to prevent the symptoms as opposed to chasing them, you know, after someone's already in a significant flare-up. So we do recommend people use their medications regularly, and if they are on allergy shots, to continue them on a regular basis throughout the spring season.
Okay, so I just want to point out to everybody that we had a lot of information delivered there, and if you want to go back and listen, George's podcast will be up 20 minutes after the show today, www.wwdbam.com. Hit for Inside Medicine. You'll see my mugshot there. And then hit podcast. But if you want to go back and just take a little slower look, because George is highly efficient, as you can see, you can basically get his recommendations off the podcast. So, George, let me ask you this. You've kind of gone over spring allergy symptoms. Is there anything else that you would want to add in?
No, I mean, with spring allergy, I think we've covered most of it. The only other thing to talk about would be, you know, what patients may benefit from allergy shots. Allergy shots have been available for a long time, over 100 years now. They're administered with the intent of lowering or maybe even, in some cases, totally eliminating allergic sensitivity to these environmental allergens, and they work quite well. And then by modifying the underlying immunology, you know, where they're making you basically less allergic, the allergy shots actually reduce the allergic sensitivity as opposed to simply, you know, treating the allergy symptoms like the medications. So, allergy shots would be one additional way that people could do better in seasons to come. Obviously, allergy shots don't work immediately. So if someone is not on allergy shots currently, they won't help for this spring, but they certainly would be helpful for next spring and years beyond.
So are allergy shots painful?
Well, allergy shots are given by a small needle that's injected subcutaneously. It's similar to an insulin syringe that you as an endocrinologist would be certainly familiar with.
Sure.
So they're not painful, but they are a needle. They may not be right for everyone, for needle phobic individuals, but generally people tolerate them quite well. And even young children down to maybe even 6-7 years of age do quite well. So they're not painful, but they are a needle. But most of our patients do okay with it, and they don't complain about it, especially when they start feeling better.
Yeah, I have to say this, that the insulin syringes that we use for diabetes have improved so much. They're so thin. They're just incredibly good, and people just don't complain. In fact, most people are shocked how little of an issue it turned out to be, yet they were all worked up, and so it's fantastic. So I guess really once they get one shot, they realize, what the heck was I worried about? How about your patient's response?
Well, it's the same type of thing as I mentioned earlier. They really do well. I mean, because we're using the same type of needle that you just referenced, and so they do tend to do just fine with it. They come in, they sit down, they get their injections. They do have to wait 30 minutes after the injections to make sure they don't have an allergic reaction, because we are injecting them with the things they are allergic to. But because of the way we do it, there's some safeguards in place that minimize the risk of a reaction. Matter of fact, we start off with a very, very small dose on their initial injections, and then there's a build-up period where that dose is increased on a weekly basis, gradually, to get them to that full therapeutic dose over several months, so they don't have much risk for an allergic reaction. Once they're at maintenance, it's, of course, much easier. They only have to come in maybe once a month as opposed to weekly during the build-up.
So would you say that that build-up phase is 1 month duration, or is it longer than that, George, or is it individualistic?
No, the build-up takes several months. It could take up to 7 or 8 months of weekly injections, because we really have to be careful, and that's pretty much across the board for allergy, not just at our practice, but it does take several months to get up to that maintenance dose. Because again, we are injecting people with things they're allergic to. So there is some risk, even though the only common reaction is redness or swelling at the site of the injection, there is some risk for a more severe allergic reaction, which is why we have to very carefully and cautiously raise that dose every week. And to your point, it is somewhat individualized. Some patients can move along a little bit more quickly. Other patients are more sensitive, and we have to put them on a slower build-up regimen, again, so they tolerate it as we build to the next dose.
So when you use those small insulin-type needles that are incredibly small, and I can say in my practice that people are just shocked how little an issue it is to take a small needle injection. So how many people would you say just, quote, freak out and just can't play the game of an allergy shot to get better long-term? How would you say is your I can't do it, doctor, answer?
Well, I think the number is low, because when I sit down with somebody and I explain to them the allergy shot process, I do make it clear to them that these are small insulin type syringes, but they are needles. And if they are needle phobic, they may have an issue. And I think by being transparent and letting people know that this is what it's all about, the particularly severe needle phobic people will kind of pull out before they even start. So because of that, because I make sure my explanation is clear at the onset, very few people take, one set of injections or two set of injections and then just say, no, sorry, I can't do this. So it's a very small number, but I think it's a very small number just because the baseline explanation gives them the insight, and then they decide even before starting whether this is a treatment that they want or not.
So the warming environment of your office basically makes that a happening. And again, when the patients get done their first shot, they would say, why was I so worried? And at least that'd be usually the set what I get in my office when we give somebody insulin for new.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's the same. Any other comments on those shots? I mean, what's the efficacy of that? Like, what's the percentage of people who say, thank God I got my allergy shots? Is it high, low, medium?
Yeah, the efficacy is very high. As long as they're compliant with the regimen, you know, if they're non-compliant with coming in for those weekly increases or non-compliant with their monthly shots, of course they won't work. But patients who are compliant, by far the vast majority gain benefit from allergy shots, because these patients also, they're carefully selected for allergy shots. Only a relatively small portion of our entire allergy population is actually on allergy shots. And these are the patients that have the most severe allergies and the strongest reactions on their allergy skin testing, of course, which we use to decide which allergens they would do best on. So it's a really high efficacy, and as long as they're compliant, it does work.
Fantastic, fantastic. So let me ask you one thing I just want to jump in about. What about peanut allergies? I assume you guys get hit with that. How well do people respond to shots for peanut allergies?
Okay. Well, with peanut allergy, there's actually no injections. Actually, for all forms of food allergy, there's no injections to desensitize patients, at least none beyond any type of experimental phase, but nothing we would do, in our practice on a clinical basis. So with peanut allergy, you know, first, of course, we have to make the diagnosis, and the diagnosis is based on the patient's history of actually having a reaction, and then we speak with the patient. We look for the typical signs or symptoms of an allergic reaction to a food, such as, you know, itching of the mouth, throat tightness, difficulty breathing or breaking out in hives, those typical anaphylactic type or systemic allergic type symptoms. And then, of course, it needs to be confirmed with some form of diagnostic testing, and that's typically skin testing. If not skin testing, we do something called immunocap testing, where we actually refer people to a laboratory, and they're able to measure levels of allergen-specific or peanut-specific antibodies, allergy antibodies, that confirm the diagnosis. So for those patients who it's a little bit more gray, we're not sure, do they have peanut allergy or not, the most definitive test is to do an oral challenge, because if they're able to eat peanuts and have no problem, obviously they have no clinically relevant peanut allergy. However, if they do have a reaction to peanut, then that would confirm the allergy on oral challenge, and they would need to avoid this food in the future to avoid any type of allergic reactions. Now, two things that have come up for the treatment of peanut allergy. Now, it doesn't allow people to eat peanuts. However, it does protect them against accidental exposures. In 2020, there was a medication called Palforzia that was approved for the treatment of peanut allergic patients 4 to 17 years of age. And it's approved to reduce the severity of allergic reactions that could occur with accidental exposure to peanut. However, again, these patients still need to avoid peanuts, so they can't have a peanut butter sandwich. Then a month ago, there was some very exciting breaking news in the world of food allergy overall. Xolair, which is a biologic medication, it's been around for many years for the treatment of asthma and hives. It was approved 1 month ago for the treatment of food allergy in individuals 1 year of age and older. But again, it was approved to reduce allergic reactions that may occur after accidentally eating foods to which these individuals have confirmed food allergies. So unfortunately, you still can't eat the foods. However, if patients take these monthly injections of Xolair on a regular basis, it can be life-saving. You know, for those patients that have life-threatening allergies, that can be triggered by an accidental exposure. So on the peanut allergy front, nothing to take away that peanut allergy, but the Palforzia and Xolair certainly help protect those patients from life-threatening reactions.
So, George, let me ask this. How about the mother who sends her child to school, and the school generally has a conniption because they don't like peanut allergies, because that creates bad press and bad results in kids. So what happens if it says this peanut? There's no peanuts in this bar, but there were peanuts made from some kind of machinery to put the bars into the wrappers. How significant is that, that if someone has a bar that says peanuts are made on this machine for this product? Any comments on that?
Well, that is one of the most difficult questions in food allergy, because, you know, from what you mentioned, the peanut or other nut is not in the ingredient list. So there certainly can be significant cross-contamination, you know, in a factory where other products are produced that do contain peanuts and or tree nuts or other allergens. And I have a hard time giving guidance on that. I have to go the conservative route and tell the patients to try to avoid even those foods to avoid having a reaction. But I do explain to them a lot of times that seems to be a legal caveat. I would think they do clean their machinery in between, but there's no clear-cut answer to that question because we really don't know the level of cross-contamination at any individual factory. And I'm sure some are much better at cleaning their machinery and some are not as good at cleaning their machinery. So you can have an accidental exposure, which then even highlights more not only the need to have possibly Xolair, which we just talked about, but to have an EpiPen immediately handy should someone have a reaction unexpectedly, you know, after reading a label and seeing that there was the allergen was not in that food.
So do schools have EpiPens available for students, or is that just a no-no? You just have to take that youngster to a hospital ER?
Schools have been better and better over the years at being prepared to treat allergic reactions to foods. Every year, of course, our office receives a boatload of forms from schools regarding food allergy and management of anaphylaxis or other severe reactions. And so the schools have been very good at maybe not having EpiPens available at the school, but requiring the student to provide an EpiPen, you know, for their personal treatment should they have an acute allergic reaction to an accidental exposure. So I think schools have really gotten on board with being mindful that some of the students do indeed have allergies. Those allergies are serious allergies and potentially life-threatening, and they are more than happy to have, at most nurses' offices, you know, products to treat those reactions like epinephrine and like antihistamines. And then we provide the guidance by filling out the forms, which serves as the recommendation for how to treat the patient when it occurs. And of course, in the school setting, we also recommend that they do call 911 if indeed somebody's having a severe reaction, not simply giving an EpiPen and send them back to class. And the schools have been very good about it, I must say. They really have come along and they really appreciate the seriousness or potential seriousness of the situation. So we really haven't had problems with schools for the most part. They've been very wary of things. And even on a classroom level, teachers are becoming more aware of the students in their classroom that have food allergies. So they're more cautious in terms of bringing different foods into the classroom to make sure that nobody's at increased risk.
So years ago, there was this big deal, because obviously I'm not an allergist, about the cost of EpiPens. What's happened to the cost of EpiPens? I mean, are some families, just priced out of having an EpiPen available? And just out of curiosity's sake, how long does an EpiPen last?
Yeah. Well, first of all, EpiPens are dated. And I encourage our patients to keep an eye on the expiration date on the EpiPen. And also to, there's a little window to make sure that the liquid is clear and there's no granules in it. But generally they do last 1 to 2 years, depending upon how good the EpiPen that you had in terms of how good the date was from the pharmacy. In terms of using it beyond that year, there have been studies that have said that EpiPens retain most of their potency up to, say, 2 years or more after the expiration. But I generally recommend that people stick with that expiration date and replace it as soon as their EpiPens expire, because then you're assured, or you should be assured, that that EpiPen will work and that that medication is in date. In terms of the cost, that was several years ago, where the actual brand name EpiPen went significantly up in price and pretty much priced most people out of having injectable epinephrine. However, since that time, there's been a flurry of generic epinephrines available, which is the same active ingredient, some in auto-injector format, some in non-auto-injector, and they've been much more affordable. So for the most part, our patients have not had problems getting some form of injectable epinephrine, if not the brand name epinephrine or EpiPen. They were able to get generic epinephrine at an affordable cost because it's so important for them to have it. So generic epinephrine's out there. There's also another brand called AviQ, which has generally been fairly affordable. And it's just another different type of auto-injector of epinephrine.
So I think the hospital attorneys were jumping up and down when you said it lasts 2 years longer. I happen to agree with you 100%, especially when something was costing $100 for a pen. But I think the hospital administrators are happy that you basically said it might be a good idea, but don't recommend it.
So, no,
that,
no,
George. That, I can just, yeah, I can see you're going to get a phone call in 10 minutes after this show. Just kidding.
Well, again, I it's best to follow the expiration date, as I mentioned, but it was only because there was a study done looking at that I even mentioned it. Because generally when it comes to expired products, I tell people to move on because we just don't know. We don't know how long a medication is good for after its expiration date.
Well, George, I agree with your explanation. It was perfect. It's just I was just going to just think if there's somebody in the attorney business might be jumping up and down now. But that's okay. They needed the exercise. can you tell me how asthma is related to allergies?
Yeah, asthma, of course, asthma is a chronic inflammatory condition of the airways of the lungs. And it's really the chest correlate to the inflammation you have ongoing in the upper airway for allergic rhinitis. And asthma is actually triggered by multiple triggers, but year-round and seasonal allergies are particular triggers for asthma, which is why allergists play such a large role in the management of asthma patients. A matter of fact, about 80% of patients with asthma actually have some form of environmental allergies. So these allergies then that promote the underlying inflammation, and then patients get those classic symptoms of chest tightness, shortness of breath, wheezing, and cough. So allergy really does play a big role. Now, asthma can also be triggered by non-allergic triggers, such as pollution, and we've all seen it being triggered by respiratory infections, but allergy is a big one, you know, when it comes to asthma.
So can you define the symptoms that most asthmatics will have? And I assume there's a range. So in other words, you know, I'm not an allergist, but is there a mild thing that would be self-limiting, or is there something that would tip somebody off with the history they give you that, hey, we got to get this person well medicated or well educated?
Yeah, I mean, asthma does have a variety of severities, from intermittent asthma through persistent forms of asthma, mild, moderate, and severe. Classic asthma symptoms are chest tightness and shortness of breath and coughing and wheezing, though some patients may only have a cough, and that's referred to as cough variant asthma. Some patients may only experience symptoms in association with exercise, so they have exercise-induced asthma. But for those patients who have daily or near daily symptoms, they would be classified as a persistent form of asthma, either mild, moderate, or severe. based on the level of their symptoms and based on, you know, pulmonary function testing to take a look at their lung function numbers, and then treatment flows from, you know, their level of severity in terms of what types of medications that they need. Obviously, patients who just have intermittent symptoms may just simply need a rescue inhaler, which is typically a bronchodilator, something like albuterol that most people are familiar with. And for more persistent forms of asthma, patients will require some form of maintenance therapy. And the gold standard of maintenance therapy for asthma, of course, has been inhaled corticosteroids because of their anti-inflammatory approach to the treatment of the underlying inflammation. And along with inhaled corticosteroids, sometimes they are teamed up with bronchodilators called long-acting bronchodilators, or even things called anticholinergic agents, which help to keep the airways open and keep the symptoms away.
So I guess the airway situation can be dramatic, because I think a lot of people just freak out. Do you ever have anybody who's got, you know, takes 100 milligrams of prednisone when they get those symptoms? I mean, how alarming is it for certain patients?
Yeah, fortunately, with the introduction of newer and better medications during my career, both in terms of those conventional medicines we talked about, and then for our more severe patients with the introduction of biologic agents, we have less and less patients that are, you know, steroid dependent in terms of oral steroids. Patients will still experience intermittent exacerbations where we try to limit their oral steroids to maybe 5 or 7 days of treatment. But in terms of, again, dosing-wise, generally not more than 30 or 40 milligrams on an initial dose, which, again, is a pretty significant dose, but we try to get it off of them off of it rather quickly. But we're fortunate. We have really very few, if any, patients right now in our practice that are on daily oral steroids for management of their asthma, largely because of the better conventional medications and because of these biologic medications. And the biologic medications, by the way, they target specific parts of the inflammatory cascade which underlies the inflammation in asthma. And we've had Xolair, which was the initial biologic, for about 21 years, but really there's been a flurry of new introductions over the past 9 years, you know, with Nucala and Fasenra and Dupixent and Tezspire, all of which have their own unique mechanism of action with all the same, you know, target of outcome, which is reducing inflammation, reducing those flare-ups that require steroids, and reducing, you know, emergency department visits and hospitalizations.
So I just wanted to bring out a point. There are certain people who can't metabolize off their steroids. So you have to remember that in World War II, the U.S. government sent these endocrine scientists up to Canada and said, we want you to find a way that we can make sure that when dive bombers dive in World War II, they don't faint. And when they did the dive bombing, they lost a lot of planes because they would lose their pressure and the plane would go down and crash. So what happened is that they developed all these synthetics like prednisone and Decadron. But it's very interesting. There is some people who will melt their bones with steroids and they just can't metabolize it off. And I probably get one of those every 10 years, but their bones just melt. So it's kind of important just to make sure that if you're on a steroid user, that you don't use too much and that you keep it low, because basically too much can mean that your adrenal gland gets fatigued and then all of a sudden you're prone to, in a stress time, you know, having a significant reaction. So one thing that nobody realizes, and this is from the endocrine side, is that you can melt bones if you're one of those people who can't metabolize off their steroids. And it just lasts forever and ever. And these people tend to get very puffy, increase a lot of fat, and they also run the risk of an adrenal crisis. So I know you didn't want to hear that, George, but I had to get that in.
Well, fortunately, we're using less and less steroids, less and less oral steroids, which are a good thing.
Amen. So do you want to move forward to how you treat asthma? in terms of any other issues?
No, I mean, the treatment of asthma is again, we're targeting the underlying inflammation and, of course, the related bronchoconstriction where the bronchial tubes kind of squeeze down and decrease the patency of those airways and make it much more difficult for that air to move through the airways. In the evaluation of asthma, of course, we use pulmonary function testing. And pulmonary function testing involves having a patient doing a series of different maneuvers to take a look at what's called spirometry, which looks at their how much air they can push out and how fast they could get it out. We took a look at lung volumes, like their total lung capacity or their residual volume, which is air trapped in their lungs that they can't get out sometime because of the asthma. And we look at their diffusion, which is looking at how well they are, well they can do at exchanging oxygen and carbon dioxide. So by using pulmonary function testing, it helps guide our treatment. And then in regard to treatment, again, because of the involvement of allergy and asthma, we certainly instruct patients in allergen avoidance measures to reduce exposure to the things we're allergic to. We talked earlier about environmental allergens like outdoor allergens, but there's also dust mite allergen and pet dander allergen, things that can really aggravate asthma in addition to nasal allergy. So we try to give them some guidance on how to reduce those exposures, though sometimes difficult. If there's a pet in the home, they're going to be exposed, you know, hence the importance of medications and allergy shots and biologics. And then we put them on their medications. As I mentioned earlier, patients with more persistent forms of asthma will require a daily regimen of maintenance medication, which is typically inhaled corticosteroids, which are the kind of the gold standard for treating the asthma inflammation, along with bronchodilators, like the long-acting bronchodilators and anticholinergics. And every patient needs a rescue inhaler to have available to use to treat an asthma attack, which is an acute constriction of their bronchial tube where they get acutely short of breath. Certainly, allergy shots are also approved and helpful for asthma, as they are for allergic rhinitis, because again, you're reducing that allergic sensitivity. And then those biologic agents I mentioned earlier, those are for our particularly severe asthmatics who we don't get adequate control on other forms of therapy, and we need to step up their treatment to be more aggressive at going at them with these biologics, which are injections every 2 to 8 weeks, depending upon the particular product, and usually we can get them under control. And again, because of this, the use of chronic daily oral steroids has really, to a large part, gone away, fortunately.
Fortunately, yes. So so you would say that allergies can be a covariant with asthma?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And it was popular maybe 10, 15 years ago about the one airway hypothesis. You know, because the nose is really connected to the lungs, it really is all one airway. So you could think of it as a unit. You know, when you're treating the nose, you're effectively treating the lungs and vice versa. Though certain medications, of course, are targeted at one or the other.
Okay, I don't have anything else to ask about allergies and asthma. Let me ask you, what about food allergies? I think we already talked about it a little bit, but can you open that path up?
Yeah, with food allergy, and again, as we mentioned a little bit ago, we make the diagnosis through skin testing or through first of all, we look at the patient's history, then we use skin testing or laboratory studies to confirm the diagnosis. Though in many patients, they really need an oral challenge to definitively, you know, come up with the answer whether they have a clinically relevant food allergy. With food allergy, there's been one very hot topic over the past, about 10 years now. You're probably familiar with red meat allergy. It was first reported actually in 2009. It was initially discovered in the southeastern United States, though it gradually made its way northward. And the thing about red meat allergy. It's known as alpha-gal allergy. It's kind of a unique type of food allergy. It's unique in terms of, you know, how it develops, and it's also unique in terms of the timing of the related reactions. People actually contract alpha-gal allergy, this food allergy, from Lone Star tick bites. And the alpha-gal is an allergy to a sugar, also called alpha-gal, that is found in all mammals except for humans and certain primates. And patients with alpha-gal can suffer life-threatening allergic reactions if they eat red meat or mammalian milk products or gelatin. There's also some reactions from administration of, like, if you administer certain medications that are derived from mammals, most notably heparin and gelatin-encapsulated medications. So, and that other unique feature of the red meat allergy is the timing of the reactions. Because when you think of a food allergy, you think of the person who, you know, takes a bite of the peanut butter sandwich and within minutes, you know, they're having those acute, severe allergic symptoms. But with red meat allergy, it's unusual because it's typically delayed from 2 to 10 hours following ingestion of the red meat, probably related to the digestion of the red meat. And people most commonly develop symptoms actually in the middle of the night if they have had red meat for dinner. And they wake up thinking, oh my God, I'm having this horrible reaction. I don't know why. But it was really from the red meat that they had had hours earlier. And they can experience all the typical anaphylactic symptoms. So they could be itchy all over. They could develop hives. They could have difficulty breathing. They can get pretty severe abdominal pain, you know, along with vomiting and diarrhea. And the treatment, as is the treatment for other acute allergic reaction to food, is to administer epinephrine immediately and to ideally call 1-1 and get to the hospital.
So can you tell me, how did that name come about? Alpha, which seems to be a Greek prefix, and gal. How did that come about? Just because it's a crazy name.
Well,
if you don't know the answer, that's okay, because I don't know the answer either.
well, what it is this. It's an allergy. The sugar that it causes an allergy to is called galactose alpha 1,3-galactose. So they shorten that long chemical name to alpha-gal, but it is galactose alpha 1,3-galactose, if you want to be correct and not call it alpha-gal. But alpha-gal has been the accepted slang word for galactose alpha 1,3-galactose.
Okay. All right. Now I learned something that I'm not going to be able to use. Just kidding. So basically, what do you have to do if somebody, if you make a diagnosis of alpha-gal and you're sitting in front of the patient, what do you have to do in that case?
Yeah, once we make the diagnosis, and by the way, the diagnosis for alpha-gal, there is no skin testing available for alpha-gal, or at least no standardized skin testing available. So we test for alpha-gal by laboratory testing called ImmunoCAP testing, where they look for specific allergy antibody levels for this alpha-gal entity. And so it's actually confirmed on laboratory testing in conjunction with the appropriate history to make the diagnosis. And once we make that diagnosis, we then have to recommend that patients avoid red meat, that they avoid milk products from, animals such as cows, and that they stay away from gelatin products, which are also sourced from animals, and to be careful with certain medications. I mentioned heparin and gelatin encapsulated medications before, but also cetuximab is a biologic that also needs to be avoided. There is no way to take away alpha-gal allergy. There's no allergy shots for alpha-gal allergy. We have noticed that the level of sensitivity sometimes wanes over time, but there's no good guidance at this point for when one may no longer be alpha-gal allergic. And interestingly, eating the meat and eating the milk, even though it causes the reactions, it doesn't make the alpha-gal allergy more severe. It's additional tick bites by these Lone Star ticks that could actually increase your allergic sensitivity. So in addition to avoiding these foods, I also have to educate people and say, listen, you also need to do everything you can when you're outdoors to avoid additional tick bites, because that will only aggravate the situation, because it was responsible for the initial allergy and will continue to increase that sensitivity if you get additional bites. And they should the only last thing is they should have an EpiPen with them, you know, because you can get accidental exposure to a meat product.
So aren't those ticks usually seen on outdoor places, like where someone has boards or tree branches hanging next to a building? Is that the usual environment of that tick? Or did I get that wrong?
Yeah, I mean, we always think of ticks as being in more wooded or forested areas, though certainly there's plenty of suburban areas in New Jersey where people can come across these Lone Star ticks. They've made their way from the southeastern United States now up to the more northern states, which is why it's becoming an issue in our area. When it was first described, it wasn't much of an issue in New Jersey, but every year I've seen, you know, more and more cases of alpha-gal allergy to deal with.
Gotcha. Let's just flip up a second, because we hope nobody sees a Lone Star tick. What about bee sting allergies? My father almost died with the bee sting bite, and my mother drove like 75 miles an hour to get him to the ER, and she used to drive 40, so you can tell it was significant. So what about bee sting allergies? How do we address that?
Yeah, with the onset of warmer weather, of course, allergic reactions to bee stings all of a sudden becomes a concern again for a lot of people. Bee sting allergy is definitely serious, as you just referenced with your dad, and it is a potentially life-threatening allergy, and people certainly do die from bee sting allergies. You know, they get the classical severe allergic symptoms. They can get whole body hives, difficulty breathing. They could drop their blood pressure. And again, they could even die from a bee sting. So it's really a big deal in our allergy world. And, you know, bee sting allergy or bee venom allergy, because it's the venom that, of course, people are allergic to, can be diagnosed either by skin testing or by laboratory studies called ImmunoCAP testing. The recommended treatment for a confirmed bee venom allergy is allergy shots, because these people really should have it. In this case, you know, an allergy shots for nasal allergy were relieving symptoms, but allergy shots for bee venom were actually saving lives. And so I really highly recommend allergy shots for people who have had a severe reaction to a bee sting and then have their bee venom allergy confirmed on either skin testing or what's called ImmunoCAP testing, which is laboratory testing, because these allergy shots for bee venom allergy are highly effective within the first 3 years, and they can be a life-saving treatment. Now, all patients who've been diagnosed with a bee sting allergy, they should carry injectable epinephrine at all times, particularly when outdoors, you know, during that warmer weather. But yeah, that is a big deal, and that is the one instance where allergy shots are, it's not just a convenience of feeling better, like with nasal allergy. This is really a life-saving type of treatment. So allergy shots play a very central role in bee sting allergy.
Fantastic. And if somebody has a bee sting and they have the stinger sitting out, do you make any recommendations how to limit that bee sting from envenoming a person?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Joe, you were breaking up there a little bit on your phone.
Sorry.
I didn't hear my question.
I just want to answer my own question. So just remember, if you have a bee sting stinger in, you don't pick it up and pull it out. You have to flick it from the bottom. Most of the envenomation might not even occur if you flick it from the bottom. Just an important way of making sure that our patients last. One last thing, George, before we have to introduce your group. You should see an allergist.
Yeah, I think anybody that has chronic sinus problems, eye and nasal allergy symptoms, asthma, hives, eczema, or especially we mentioned you were talking about food allergies and bee sting allergy, really should see an allergist, because we can design an individualized treatment program, you know, including allergen avoidance and medications, in some instances, biologics and allergy shots that can help people get better, you know, and get better control of their allergy-related medical conditions, and they can benefit from a much improved quality of life. I'd just like to end up with some short information. The name of our practice is the Allergy and Asthma Doctors. Our phone number is 856-235-8282. I have two great partners, Dr. Don DeBorn and Dr. David LaRosa, who are experts in the fields of allergy, asthma, and immunology. We have offices in Mount Laurel, Woodbury, and Philadelphia. And our website is yourallergydocs.com. That's yourallergydocs.com. And our phone number again is 856-235-8282.